The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello, and welcome to Short Circuit, your podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeals. I'm your host, Anthony Sanders, Director of the Center for Judicial Engagement at the Institute for Justice. If you enjoy this podcast, you should check out our newsletter, an often irreverent take on recent Court of Appeals opinions, which we publish every Friday. You can subscribe at shortcircuit.org or find it on the Volokh Conspiracy blog. And please also check out our sister podcast, the documentary series, Bound by Oath. We're recording this Friday, May 28th, 2021, and we have what you might call the Big Ten Eastern Division episode. That's because, with apologies to the other members of that half of the conference from other states, today we have cases from Ohio and Michigan, and both, of course, from the Sixth Circuit. In fact, we wanted to go straight to the front lines to find out what was going on, so we have a special guest who litigated one of the cases. Emily White is a partner at Dan Law in Columbus, Ohio. There, she practices in the areas of student loan debt, disability rights, and consumer law. Previously, she worked for Legal Aid Society of Cleveland and Disability Rights Ohio. She's a graduate of City University of New York School of Law and of the University of Illinois on the other side of the Big Ten. Emily, welcome to Short Circuit.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Now, Emily is going to tell us about a takings case appeal on a preliminary issue, but a very important preliminary issue that she recently won at the Sixth Circuit. But first, let me introduce IJ attorney Kirby Thomas West. Although a native Pennsylvanian, which is in the Third Circuit, of course, Kirby has agreed to kindly tell us about a case from Michigan, or as our Ohio State listeners say, the state up north, which is a tribal law case with some really interesting history and follows up to some extent on a case some of you may remember from last year's Supreme Court term, McGirt versus Oklahoma. Kirby, welcome back to Short Circuit.
Thanks, Anthony. I'm happy to be here, although as a big-time Penn State fan, it pains me a little bit that we're focusing so much on Michigan and Ohio today.
Right. Well, at least we're in that division. And
there you go.
You can rest assured our episode on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court from last fall hopefully can keep you happy. And listeners, of course, can go back and find that in the archives. Now, Emily, tell us about your case, Harrison versus Montgomery County. And maybe you can start off by recounting what happened to your client, Elena Harrison.
Sure. So my client owned a home where she had delinquent property taxes. And in this case, the home was actually worth more than what was owed on the property taxes. And in Ohio, shortly after the Great Recession, there was a movement to address vacant and abandoned lands. And one of the problems that the legislature was encountering, especially at the end of the Great Recession, was that sometimes the property tax delinquency was worth actually more than what the property was worth. It was hard to find people to buy these properties after a tax foreclosure. And so what that meant is that you'd have communities that had land that was essentially not used, that people would walk away from. We'll say in this day and age, that's not so much of a concern, but that was the context of the law that we challenged in this case, which what it did was, prior to the law, whenever there was a tax delinquency, the government would have to bring a foreclosure and try to sell the property to collect the property taxes. And the legislature decided to create a new streamlined procedure where, instead of selling the property could be directly transferred to a land bank and extinguish the property tax and then very quickly get it into the hands of, a land bank for economic development purposes. While the law was intended to address situations where the property taxes were worth less than what the property was worth, in practice now, in thousands of cases across our state, this procedure is being used in cases where properties are worth more than what the taxes are owed. And so in our case, we brought a takings claim, not to challenge the tax foreclosure itself, but to challenge the taking of the surplus equity, which was modest in this case, but could be very large in other cases. And in this case, at the trial court level, the court said that the claim was precluded, that we could not bring a constitutional takings claim for just compensation because that should have been raised in the adjudication of the tax foreclosure itself. And so we appealed that decision to the Sixth Circuit, and we argued that we really didn't get a chance to raise a claim for just compensation because it didn't become ripe until after the property was taken, which was at the conclusion of the process, not the beginning of the process. And ultimately, the Sixth Circuit agreed that we have our day in court, that we have the right to litigate this claim. And Judge Sutton, who wrote the opinion, reiterated what the Supreme Court announced in this case, Nic, in the prior year, that whenever there is a constitutional violation, individuals have a constitutional remedy. They can go directly to federal court to assert that claim. And that's just what we did in this case. And we're pleased with the court's decision and reasoning and the fact that our client finally has the opportunity to litigate her claim and seek just compensation.
And the case is a class action, I understand. Maybe tell us a little bit about that, and then where is it in the whole class action certification process?
Sure. So we actually, this case concerned the practices of Montgomery County, Ohio, which is Dayton. There's a companion case that we have also brought in Cleveland that is still pending. And actually, class certification was recently denied on the question of evidentiary. How do you prove what the amount of surplus equity is? We asserted an argument that because the value of the property is really baked into the property tax, and that one of the things that is decided in the tax foreclosure process is the validity of the tax lien, that it's fair to use the tax valuation to determine what the value of the property was at the time of the taking. Our trial court disagreed with that and granted an in limine motion following the ordinary rule in other non-tax cases is that tax foreclosure is not, the tax valuation is not used to determine valuation, that you have to use other appraisal methodology. And once they decided that you basically have to have an individual appraisal for every single property, they concluded that it would be unmanageable to have all those cases litigated in one class action. So we have a petition for interlocutory review of that denial of class certification that is still pending with the Sixth Circuit, and our Cleveland case is on hold until we get that determination.
I see. And the facts of your named plaintiff, I found particularly galling. That she had this property moved into a land bank, and then the county claimed she should have appealed that determination to state court. And I think she had something like, you could correct these numbers, but
15 days.
Right, 15 days to appeal it. And yet she had a right of redemption of 28 days. And it wouldn't be till after those 28 days that her property right was even extinguished because of how a right of redemption works, where you actually pay the taxes back and get the property back. And so she was in this like bizarro never world where she could never even raise her constitutional claim. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And one of the things that we argue that I kind of wish the court had delved into a little bit more is the nature of the takings claim itself. It seems to me that there are different types of takings that you can raise. One is the classic HELO taking, where you're essentially raising the claim defensively to say, don't do the taking at all. But there is another type of taking, which is one for just compensation, that I think is distinguishable from the defensive claim. Perhaps it would make sense that if you want to raise it defensively, that you would have to raise that claim in the proceeding to stop the taking itself, to stop the physical taking of the property. But in this case, we're actually respecting and acknowledging that the transfer of the property has happened, and we cannot undo it as much as my client would like that. But what the Supreme Court and Nic says is once that taking occurs, the claim for just compensation arises immediately at that moment. My client is entitled to compensation. And so there's a little bit of that discussion in the opinion about ripeness. When does the claim for just compensation become ripe? And yes, I could talk all day about the finer points of Ohio administrative law, but for a variety of reasons, the court is absolutely right to say there are procedural barriers to raising this kind of claim in conjunction with an appeal. An administrative appeal is literally an appeal. You have a defined record. The reviewing court doesn't ordinarily take new evidence. You can't ordinarily raise new claims. The statute says you can raise new issues. Issues and claims are different. And procedurally, it is possible, as a court of concurrent jurisdiction, that you could go to the state common pleas court, which is our court of general jurisdiction, and raise a 1983 claim. But because an administrative appeal is so distinct, that actually can't be maintained in the same action without consolidating the cases. So even the appeal, you file an appeal in a very particular way. It's not a summons and complaint. To combine a 1983 action, you would have to do a summons and complaint and then procedurally join them on a claim that isn't ripe yet, because as you mentioned, the redemption right doesn't expire until 14 days after the appeal is over. And I think that getting back to what Nick says, you know, look, for constitutional claims, a plaintiff does have the right to go to federal court. And this one, there really has not been a fair opportunity to litigate this just compensation issue, nor does litigation of the just compensation issue in any way undermine the decision made by the Board of Revisions, the underlying decision. I mean, they can live together. I mean, in fact, one has to happen before the other is ripe.
Kirby, how do you see this case?
I think your point about the kind of difference between focusing on the public use question versus the just compensation question is a really interesting one, because I think in IJ litigation, we often think a lot about, you know, what constitutes a public use. But as you say, that's obviously only half of the equation when you're thinking about takings claims. So I think that's an interesting thing that you bring up in your case.
And I like how you explain how you could join in 1983 claim, for which, for non-lawyer listeners, I shouldn't have to remind you, because we had a big event on the Section 1983's 150th anniversary last month. But just in case you missed that, it is the mechanism where most people sue a person who's acting under color of law for a violation of the Constitution. And you could join that to an administrative appeal in state court. But I bet if you did that, the county attorney or the state's attorney would raise all kinds of issues about how, there's no jurisdiction to have one and the other. The court would be better managed to have one stayed and have the other adjudicated and have ripeness. So it's not like everything would be hunky-dory if you went down that road, which is why I really like what happened with your case here, which is Nick cleared up a lot of confusion, or not just confusion, but absurdity in the lower courts about pretty much extinguishing having a federal claim in federal court for a taking. And so now that you have that, I love how Justice Sutton put it in the opinion, that there's a roadmap to how you have a case in federal court. And if these arguments that the county threw up and the state threw up in this case had any water, then Nick basically, you know, might have, well, not even have been decided.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, Judge Sutton also, at oral argument, he said, you know, there are some of us who think that there's something sacred about federal court jurisdiction, and that individuals should have the right to access the federal courts to seek a constitutional remedy for constitutional violations. And there are, you know, many good things about Nick. One of them is that they corrected that sort of historic wrong of having this judge-made exhaustion rule harden into a procedural barrier that prevents individuals from accessing justice.
Do you know if this issue came up at all when this legislation was passed? Because it seems pretty obvious when you just if you just move it to a land bank and it's all gone, that this might come up, or was it just overlooked?
I think that it was overlooked, and I'll say too, you know, I was a legal aid attorney during the Great Recession in Cleveland, representing homeowners. In some cases, in situations where a home would be terribly unsafe, they didn't have the means or the resources or the desire to fix them up, And they really needed a place and a way to responsibly, you know, hand over the property. There is definitely a place for land banks, and that's really what this was. That's really what this was aimed at. And there really were situations where, you know, it takes about $8,000 to demolish a property, and so, you know, negotiations would be how much am I going to pay to get out of this house as opposed to keeping it. And I think that the purpose of this legislation, people really had not imagined that the land banks would use, that this process would be used in cases where people did have surplus equity. But I will say historically, and in my, the rest of my, you know, consumer practice, you know, tax foreclosures can happen to many people for a variety of reasons who aren't necessarily, you know, bad neighbors, bad property owners. You know, in this case, which is very common, you have a house that's been in a family for a very long time, and you have a family member who dies intestate, and it's a little bit unclear who owns the property. And that happens all the time. And we've seen also from the way that tax foreclosure is used in Michigan, for instance, I think it's very illustrative of how it's used generally, you know, these can fall harder on elderly folks, folks who are no longer paying a mortgage and therefore don't have an escrow of a mortgage company that's going to make sure that the taxes are caught up. It can happen when people, you know, have to go to the hospital for longer than they expect, or folks that decline in health. And you can have a lifetime of equity and savings extinguished through a very quick process. And I'll say too, another thing about this process that I don't like is it applies towards vacant and abandoned properties, but the statutory definition of vacant and abandoned doesn't match the common sense understanding of what that might mean. So in this case, the counties have basically reduced it to a form where they see, is the property unoccupied when an inspector looks at it? The form that they used in this case, they claim that they visited my client's home in a snowy January and observed tall weeds and grass that wasn't mowed on one visit. And that's how the property was certified as being vacant or abandoned.
Oh, my.
And so I do think that while land banks have an important role in our communities, I think that when they start targeting properties that have surplus equity, I think that they've somewhat lost their way.
Yeah, well, that raises all kinds of suspicions often that we deal with here at IJ about, you know, is it property targeted for redevelopment? Is there other purposes that the county has for wanting to have a new owner of that land?
Well, I don't think they're transparent either. I don't think they're hiding the ball on that part, that this is for economic redevelopment. They do land assembly. Some of these parcels have been used for stormwater remediation programs with the EPA, having more property that, you know, is absorbing water, and other just absolutely classic economic development purposes. And some of those are very, very good for our community. But don't reach out and use this in a case where you're extinguishing people's equity. This statute can be applied perfectly constitutionally in the way it was originally intended, which was going after those properties that really are worth less than what the property tax is owed.
Right. Well, even our client, Suzette Kilo, in the famous Kilo case you mentioned, although we didn't think her taking her home was a public use, she at least got paid for it. And they took the home, the entire value. One last question I want to ask you before we move on is, Judge Sutton ends this opinion very curiously in where he says, well, when you go back down to district court, you may want to solicit evidence about the meaning of a taking, both in 1791 and 1868, which is really interesting. It goes back to a podcast we had a couple episodes ago we don't need to get into. But also, this panel stands ready to handle the appeal promptly. Do you know if that's normal for them to the same panel to be there? Because I know in the Eighth Circuit, where I've had some appeals, it generally isn't.
I mean, generally, courts do try to take related cases, but I've never seen a call quite this direct to say we're eager to decide the merits. I will say I really appreciated the engagement of the panel and the quickness of issuing the opinion. I mean, it came out a week and a half after argument, which was amazing. And I also think that from a judicial prudence perspective, the approach here was the right one. They did solicit the involvement of the Ohio Attorney General's office, who essentially tried to make an argument that wasn't really addressed in the lower courts about whether there is even a takings claim on the merits, whether my client has a property interest in her surplus equity. And I think that that really is a matter of first impression that does require more thought and more, I think, more input from the parties on the court before deciding. And I think that that's really what that's saying is now we're going to get to a question of, does an individual have a property interest in their surplus equity? And I think there are very strong arguments that they do. Our friends at the Pacific Legal Foundation submitted an amicus brief, laying out the historical arguments for the government has the right to its taxes, but it doesn't have the right to more than its taxes. The government should take the smallest amount necessary to pay 100% of their taxes, and that there's a historical line of cases saying, and when you're taking a thing to pay the property taxes, you have to liquidate it so that you can extract its value and return the surplus. And those are the lines of cases and thought that we intend to invoke in making the argument that you can't just extinguish that surplus equity. It was a real property interest, and we think there should be just compensation for it.
Yes, and I should add, at oral argument, I know that unusually there were four parties who argued, and Christina Martin, who was on this podcast last year on a different case, argued on behalf of Amicus Pacific Legal, and we're going to put a link up to the argument for in the show notes, so you can hear. I think both Emily and Christina did some very powerful oral argument that you can learn a lot from if you're getting ready for your own case somewhere. So there was some powerful advocacy. Well, thank you, Emily, for coming on and talking about that Sixth Circuit case from Ohio. Now we're going to go north to Michigan. In fact, northern Michigan. And Kirby, tell us what's going on there and what this dispute is about. What happened in 1855.
So we have another case, as you mentioned, out of the Sixth Circuit. It's Little Traverse Bay Band of Ottawa Indians versus Whitmer. And this, as you mentioned also, this case goes back quite a ways. So it deals with a tribe, or I suppose more accurately, kind of a conglomeration of tribes in northern Michigan called the Little Traverse Bay Band of Ottawa Indians, which is made up of members of the Ottawa and Chippewa tribes. The band at the time that Indian tribes were being forced westward really wanted to stay in Michigan. And in an effort to do that, they tried to work with the United States government in the 1800s to find out how they could retain their presence within northern Michigan. These efforts ultimately led to a treaty in 1836. And in that treaty, the federal government said that they would pay the tribe's debts. They would give the tribe annuities for 20 years to go towards education, medicine, agriculture. And in return, the tribe ceded 14 million acres to the United States. This is one third of present day Michigan. So it's a lot of land that was ceded to the United States. And the rate they were paid for that was, I think, around 16 cents per acre, which came up later in about 100 years later in a dispute in front of the Indian Claims Commission. For the 1836 treaty, it also established a reservation in Little Traverse Bay for the band to live on. But unlike some reservations, there was a very short time limit on the existence of this reservation of only 5 years. And the government said in the treaty, then at the end of this 5 years, we will pay $200,000 for the land and facilitate if you want your movement westward to another reservation. Unsurprisingly, the management after this was kind of subpar. Nothing really happened at the end of the 5 years. The band continued to live there. The government really didn't do anything. And so ultimately, almost 20 years later, they revisit this issue and propose a new treaty. So there's a new treaty in 1855. And this treaty does not reestablish the reservation, but rather gives specific plots of land to families that are members of the band. So specifically, each head of a family could get 80 acres, and each single person over the age of 21 could get 40 acres. And there was a 10-year time frame set for them to select which land they would choose, each, you know, head of family and each single person. And again, the program was not administered particularly well. At the end of 10 years, a lot of Indian families had not had an opportunity to select their land. Some ultimately bought the land when it went back to kind of the regular market that was open to both, you know, settlers and Native Americans. But ultimately, at the end of the 10 years, when that time period had passed, about 1,800 members had received about 120,000 acres of land. And so the issue that came up more recently in 2015 is that the band sued the state of Michigan, arguing that what happened in the Treaty of 1855 was that a reservation had been established and that the land that they were living on in Michigan was actually an Indian reservation, which has, you know, obviously implications for governance of that land. The district court said, no, this is not a reservation. And the Sixth Circuit on appeal affirmed that decision. And in so doing, they applied a legal test for what constitutes an Indian reservation. It's a two-part test. It asks, was the land set aside for, quote-unquote, Indian purposes? And second, it's was the land under federal superintendence at the time that it was given to the Indians, and was that set up, you know, to continue to be under federal superintendence? The answer the Sixth Circuit gives to both of these questions is no. And in so doing, you know, they note that they have an obligation and there's a precedent in favor of establishing or of interpreting treaties between the government and Indian tribes to broadly, you know, in favor of the Indians, and that, you know, any kind of – there's kind of a presumption that they will be construed in favor of the Indians in close calls. But looking at the circumstances of the treaty and the text of the treaty, they note that unlike establishment of other Indian reservations, what really was happening here was allotment of specific tracts of land to individuals and to individual families. The title, for example, wasn't given to the tribe as a whole or in community. It was, you know, individual titles of land given to each family. And they also look at some comments of tribal leaders at the time, including a tribal leader and historian who, shortly after the treaty was signed, said that the tribe had abandoned, quote, its laws, customs, and manners, and, quote, unquote, renounced their chiefdoms, and now considered themselves to be operating under the laws of the state of Michigan and having equal rights and privileges with American citizens. Similarly, with the question of whether the land was under federal superintendence, the court notes a lot of differences between the Treaty of 1855 and the establishment of other Indian reservations. And while there was this kind of federal administration in allotting the land to the members of the band, there was not the same kind of federal superintendence that that was set up to kind of in perpetuity to oversee the establishment of other Indian reservations. I think that looking at the treaty and looking at kind of the statements of the tribal members at the time, I think it's right, probably. The Sixth Circuit is right that this did not create an Indian reservation, the Treaty of 1855, but it is, like so much of Native American history in the United States, just kind of heartbreaking to think about and read about. Like I said, you know, all of these treaties came out of the band's desire to try to stay in Michigan and not have to be forced westward like so many Native Americans were at that time. And I think that this was the agreement that they ultimately settled on. But looking at just how both treaties were administered and how really to the detriment of Native Americans, the federal government did not always expeditiously follow through on its promises to the Native Americans or at all in some cases. As I mentioned, there were other claims related to the treaties that had to be settled in the 1930s and 40s under the Indian Claims Commission that were kind of separate and apart from this case. It's just, yeah, I think it really does highlight the kind of troubled history of Native Americans in the United States.
Emily, your thoughts?
One of the, I'll start by saying my knowledge of tribal law and Native American law is somewhat limited. But one of the things that strikes me as somebody who practices real estate law is that one of the things that this turns on is what kind of title was delivered to the individual tribal members. And there are all these indications that the title that they received was not really good fee simple title, that there were restrictions on who they could transfer or sell the property to. There was an indication that they could only transfer the property, for instance, to other tribal members. And then finally, circling back to our earlier case, there's an indication that many tribal members had lost their homes to tax foreclosure cases in Michigan. And so it just seems that if this is premised on what kind of title and what kind of grant of land Native Americans received out of this deal, they didn't really receive fee simple title, and they were treated differently and collectively as a tribe for this. And while also giving that imperfect title to these Native Americans, there are all these references throughout the opinion where the government is also not providing the basic government services that were provided to non-tribal members. So you get a worse grant of land, but then you also don't get the benefits of education and other government services that any other member of Michigan would receive. And I just look at it, and, you know, in addition to anybody negotiating with Andrew Jackson right after he, you know, took the state of Georgia by force from the Cherokees, if we're using basic contract principles, unconscionability, both substantive and procedural, would seem to be present here. Overall, it just seems like a terribly bad deal. My only other comment, though, is just wondering what the goal of this litigation is today. My only other connection or interaction with the Chippewa Indians is in my practice representing consumers. And the Lockview Desert Band of Lake Superior Chippewas is a very large major payday lender that issues really, truly awful loans on terms that would be illegal under federal and state law. And I have represented folks that were tangled up with loans that were truly unconscionable. And I don't know if one injustice is canceled out by another, but you know that is a big part of that sovereign immunity is a big part of what's necessary to really extract the maximum from consumers in payday loans. And I don't know if that plays into what the goal of this case was.
I think that's a really great point about the quality of the title that was given to the families, to the Native American families in this case. And one thing that that makes me wonder, which I don't recall as being very clear in the opinion, was the fact that not all of the land was distributed within the 10-year allotment. And that had that kind of delineation of what the title would look like when the land was given to the Native American families. But then it mentions that, you know, at least some part of the tribe purchased their land once it actually went to kind of the open market. And so I wonder if the Native Americans who ended up purchasing their land after the 10-year allotment actually got better title. Oh, sorry. Sorry about the interruption with my phone call.
Kirby is an actual working attorney, unlike myself, so that's okay.
But I do wonder if, if there was different title for some families, and if so, how many, and if so, how that would affect determining, you know, the tribe's kind of argument about what exactly does the reservation look like? What land is included in that reservation?
It's also curious, though, that the role is assigned to the tribes to essentially handle the distribution of title, which is really a sovereign-type role. If they're saying, we're negotiating with you as sovereigns, and you're going to decide how your people hold title to the land, then that, again, is another, another factor that kind of leans towards this was maybe more like a reservation. Although, then again, I don't know. I'm not a tribal law expert, but that test of what is a reservation just seems like an awkward one. And I'm not sure, you know, why that particular test of all things should exist when you're talking about relations among sovereigns.
Yeah, I agree.
And other negotiations that weren't fair. So
I agree that it is an unusual thing. And I think as someone else who is also very much not an expert in tribal law, it was sort of surprising to me. And, you know, I thought about this when, Anthony, you mentioned the McGirt case when that came out last year. It was sort of just surprising to me that this is a question. Like, we don't know what Indian reservations are. How, you know, it just seems hard to believe that in, you know, 2020, 2021, we still don't really know what the nature of agreements with Native American tribes are. And I think it's, you know, a little embarrassing for us that we haven't figured out what the obligations to Native American tribes are and what these agreements look like. And just as background for those who don't know, Anthony mentioned the McGirt case that was decided last year. And in that case, the Supreme Court said that much of eastern Oklahoma, which we hadn't understood in this way, was actually, you know, a reservation. It was actually tribal land. And it was something that most people operating in that area of the law did not think. So just an interesting thing that this is still all a developing area of law at this point.
Mm-hmm. And interesting part about McGirt versus this case is there unquestionably was a reservation created. After all, Oklahoma originally was called Indian Country. And then it's whether the federal government ever abrogated that, or there was, you know, as part of some treaty or whatever it is, an act of Congress that it was taken away. And Justice Gorsuch went through all the history there and said, you know, they never quite did that. Although people thought that they did, they never quite did that. Whereas in this case, although there was that earlier reservation, with the later treaty, it's like whether it was created in the first place. And perhaps one way you put these two together, whether this is actually the law or not, is it's going to be harder to go one direction than to go the other direction. Now, I should point out McGirt was 5-4. The dissenters were pretty adamant that Gorsuch was reading the treaty or the later acts of Congress wrong. So it's still going to be, despite that victory in that case on Oklahoma, it's still going to be a very hard slog for a tribe when they're in this type of environment. I should point out that we did, as some listeners may know, we did at the Center for Judicial Engagement a survey of all 50 states' constitutional history, that is state constitutional history, last year, and we did this on the best medium for it, which is Twitter threads. And you can check my Twitter account for that. And we'll put a link up to this actual thread. But we did a thread on Oklahoma. And I can't remember if I think it was after McGirt came out. But the history of how Andrew Jackson and others moved Native Americans to Oklahoma, to Indian Country, which got smaller and smaller over the years and became Oklahoma, is just a really fascinating history of how these relations occurred. And of course, that happened all over the country, not just in Georgia and Oklahoma, but it gives you a little bit, perhaps, of background on what's going on in this case. So I promise in the future, we will have other cases where we know more about the actual case, such as Emily White knows about her own case, which we talked about this week. But it's important to get a well-rounded picture of what's going on at the federal courts of appeals and judicial engagement and when judges are protecting our liberties and when they are not. So thank you so much, Emily, for coming on with us. We wish you the best of luck in continued litigation for property rights of Ohioans. Kirby, thank you for coming on also. And as always, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast. And I'd say for all the rest of you, please remember to get engaged.